record.
Oh, we got one spot in the front. Is there somebody who's squished in the back or who would like to have a... Well, here we go.
Nope. Satan.
She's fleeing. I've had enough of this. All right. Well, there is that space in the front. Don't all rush at once for it. Conflict. In the Pali Canon, the Buddha laid conflict at the... he said there were several causes for it. At one point in a famous sutta, the Honeyball Sutta, he said that the Buddha taught that conflict with others is caused by papancha, which is the obsessive stream of generally self-related thinking or obsessive thought that runs through the mind, that inner autobiography that takes everything personally, that wonders what's going to happen to me, you know, what do people think about me, is this good for me or bad for me, what happened to me in the past. There's also room in the front if you want to sit.
Right.
Yeah. Feel free to come up. Another cause, he said, in a memorable sutta in the middle length discourses is that conflict with others is caused by the fact that we're always looking for comfort and happiness and security in external material things. In other words, we look to surround ourselves with objects and money and pretty looking young people, such as we have here, that to make ourselves feel safe and secure. And so we're constantly fighting over ever dwindling resources for our security and our happiness. And in fact, the Buddha used the analogy of fish flopping about in a drying up puddle. So that's another reason. And then I suppose that, in fact, I know for certain that neuroscientists would argue that there's a part of the subregions of the mind, the amygdala, the fight or flight section of the brain that looks for dangers and threats. And this part of the mind is not very smart. It's actually one of the oldest regions of the brain. And it often mistakes threats and dangers where there are none. So the sum of it is that conflict is not going to go away anytime soon. And we often have conflict in our lives, whether real or imagined. And when there is conflict with another, generally, what the human tendency is to actually often make things worse. How do we do that? Well, when we're having a dispute or we've had an interaction with somebody that we find unpleasant or we don't like the way it's resolved or the way things went, we tend to do two immediate things, which is one, apportion blame, which splits off into that son of a bitch, i.e. blaming the other, or B, if we feel slightly uncomfortable with our actions, what we've said or done, then we often fall into self-justification to make the discomfort go away. The third possibility is we're the kind that likes to judge ourselves harshly. Instead of justifying our actions, we might sit around and beat up ourselves and think thoughts like, oh, there I go again, fucking up. So, of those tendencies, sitting around blaming, judging ourselves, or excusing our acts, indulging that inner defense counsel, either way, the result is all the same. It's even more papancha or obsessive thought. And what we don't do, what is the most skillful thing, which is simply to sit and feel the sadness that there's been an uncomfortable interaction, often with somebody we care about or somebody that's at least important in our lives. So instead of turning towards the feelings we feel a sense of, or feeling the remorse or feeling the discomfort, we go into excessive thinking. What is the matter with that person? What's the matter with me? Or I was right to say what I did. And this, in turn, creates more agitation and more discomfort. And when we keep firing the amygdala, it releases cortisol, which engages the sympathetic nervous system, which tightens the stomach and also creates hyperventilation and creates a really uncomfortable somatic expression of resentment. And the more we push this down, we don't want to feel the discomfort and the sadness, the more it turns into feeling like something that's overpowering. Anger or resentment can turn into something that's really, really hard to be with because we've repressed it so much. We've pushed it away when it was in its very first incarnation after a conflict experience. Instead of turning towards it, we've pushed it down with all this thinking and ideation. And over time, the repression and the continued triggering of the amygdala turns this, what was at one point something we could have felt easily, into something that feels like it's going to overwhelm us and take us over. And what happens then is people vent because they feel so uncomfortable with all these thoughts of, you know, what's the matter with the world? What's the matter with me? How dare you? And then the physical discomfort and the hyperventilation, we just want to, yeah! And we want to shake. We want to get the feelings out of us. We don't want to feel them. We just want to push them out. I don't want to feel this. I want to push it out on you. So we either vent on the person that we blame or we find a sympathetic ear. Can you believe what I got about it? And the other end, like, speakerphone. That's horrible. That's terrible. What's going on? Who's on the phone? Forget it. So that's what happens. We vent, and of course, venting doesn't work because it only creates even more stress. It doesn't relieve or treat the core inner wounding. One of the base experiences that allows us to trigger serotonin, the neurotransmitter that allows us to feel good and feel relaxed, is bonding and feeling safe around others. So when we've experienced conflict and when there's agitation and resentment, there's very little serotonin being released. There's lots and lots of adrenaline and cortisol and even dopamine for a short-term blast when we vent. But there's no lasting, relaxing neurotransmitters that allow us to go, ah. And when we vent, all we're doing is creating even more drama, even more narrative, even more ideation, and we're still not turning to feel the inner manifestations of the wounding, the hurt, the sense of discomfort that we feel when a connection we have with another human being has been broken up. So the overall practice, of course, is at first, if possible, to nip it in the bud and to feel the feelings of sadness and or regret and or discomfort when the conflict or right after the conflict happens. Just turn to it. Don't narrate it. Don't figure it out. Just sit with it and allow it to unfold. But in the case of where that's blocked and it's turned into a resentment, then there are certain practices that we can turn to that build up and restore connection and empathy where it's been lost. So that's what I'm going to be speaking of mostly, if not entirely. So empathy is a human capacity that is actually ingrained. When we talk about the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes that the Buddha said are the safest attitudes for the mind to reside in, a lot of three of the four Brahma Viharas are not ingrained to the mind. Metta, loving kindness, is something that really has to be cultivated. Certainly appreciation, rejoicing in the happiness of another, is not ingrained often in the mind. And certainly balance or upekkha is not a natural, if it is a natural default wiring, neuroscientists haven't uncovered the region of the brain responsible for this. But neuroscientists have, in fact, uncovered what creates compassion or empathy. There is actually what's known as mirror genes. And this was a fascinating discovery that was came about in Italy. They were doing some research with a monkey, which... and the research, I believe, was just to see when which part of the monkey's subregions of their brain was responsible for movements and fear and stuff like that. So they had the monkey hardwired to the fMRI scan, and they'd already noticed which part of the monkey's subregions were responsible for eating and using its hands and digesting and all that. So they knew that. And in one fascinating moment, the neuroscientists reached for a peanut and you know, took out the peanut and ate it. And his colleague was looking at that moment at the fMRI scans and noticed that the monkey's brain was reacting as if it, the monkey, had grabbed the peanut, had, you know, taken off the shell, had eaten it, and had started to swallow. So the monkey was completely empathetic with the experience, probably wished it was it instead of the scientist. This is the core neurons that allow or create that condition when you're watching a TV show and it's a dark night in the show and there's a sound up in the attic and it's one woman and you might not even be a woman, but you're there. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? Why am I going up into the attic? This sucks. This is really stupid of me. And she goes up. Why am I opening that door? Normally I would be smarter than this, but look, here I am. I really suck in this moment. Or going down in the basement, you know. What the fuck? So we empathize. We put ourselves literally in. And sometimes when we see somebody, you know, get injured, we feel it. When we see somebody who's really in pain, we can actually feel it. So it's actually a hardwired ability. And when it's blocked by confrontations and traumatic events in life, what can happen over time if we don't restore this ability is that we actually can create the conditions of narcissism or paranoia. It's a really fundamental ability that allows us to engage peacefully with others. And the more we block empathy, the more we shut down to this ability to connect with others, the more we isolate, separate, and the more we create the causes and conditions for other serious psychological effects. So, what does empathy entail? Well, it entails basically three things. The first is connecting or attuning or attending to someone, basically holding somebody in our awareness without giving in to that inner judge. What the fuck are they doing?
why don't they stop talking so I can talk? Because I've got something really interesting to say.
You know, that voice that pulls us away, that blocks us, that doesn't allow us to truly take in another human being, to really hold someone in our attention without allowing our attention to be divided or split. That's attuning or attending or connecting. The second part is reading. Clinical psychologists have a bunch of different ways of phrasing this, including awareness of the other's mind. And basically it means looking behind the specific words that they say and seeing beneath to the underlying emotion that lies beneath what they're saying. So when somebody's angry with us or when somebody's disappointed, sometimes if we are really calm, we can see beneath the attacks and the accusations and the harsh words, we can see, oh wow, this person's really hurting, they feel vulnerable, they feel defenseless, and they just want us to know that. So it's about not getting caught up in all the stuff they're saying and taking a moment to at least read what their body is saying, read what the tone of their voice is saying, read what their eyes are saying, read the overall experience, not just the words. Very often, this is why texting can be one of the, while it can be wonderful at certain times, it can be the absolute worst thing that's ever happened to real human communication. Because just sit around and listen to your friends who are dating these days. Half of the experience involves trying to interpret what that text meant. I said, hey, what's up? And she said, nothing. What do you think that meant? I don't know. I could think about that, but I prefer to go into the bathroom and hang myself. I prefer to stab myself in my leg with my fork, so I don't know. So that's the second, and the third part is feeling what the other person is feeling. So that means, you know, when someone is expressing being overwhelmed or really sad, if we really open to it, if we really take in somebody's sadness or somebody's fear, there can be a slight sympathetic experience in our own bodies. We can actually feel the loneliness in our chest that they might feel, or the tightness in our belly, or the tightness in our shoulders, the somatic expression. We might have a sympathetic feeling. In general, our feeling is always going to be far less intense, and that's a good thing, because if we were simply carried away by the emotions of another, we wouldn't be able to give them helpful attention. We wouldn't be able to see and occasionally interject when we have some experience that might be useful. So it's a good thing that we, on the one hand, feel it, but at the same time, it doesn't overwhelm us. So we can feel another person's sadness, but that sadness is not as strong in us as it is in them. So these are the three manifestations of empathy: attuning or attending to someone, reading the emotions beneath their words in what underlies what they're saying, what they're trying to get across, what their goal is. Interestingly enough, I've read with actors that when actors want to get into a part, they don't really learn the lines first. They try to figure out what that character wants in every scene. And that allows them to then learn the lines, because the lines come naturally once you understand what the person's after. So trying to read that underlying emotional state, and then the third is feeling in the body, a sympathetic expression. Now, spiritual practice can fall generally under two types. The Buddha spoke of wisdom and compassion, which basically means dry or wet. Wisdom being something that's rather intellectual, and compassion or an emotional heart experience is something that has to be felt. And the bulk of developing empathy and compassion and forgiveness, which is the final key to dealing with conflict, is very much a wet practice. It's not a practice that's intellectual. Of course, we can use our wisdom. We can remind ourselves that while we're resenting someone, we are suffering ourselves. The Buddha said that anger and resentment was like holding a burning coal in our hand, waiting to throw it at someone. We can reflect on the fact that our anger is not strong enough to really affect someone. If it was, Dick Cheney would not be doing so well right now. Because I alone would have done. I try to be harmless and wish all beings unlimited peace, but with some beings I stumble. So it turns out our anger and our resentment are not as all powerful as we'd like to believe. And the sitting around thinking, when I see them the next time, and if there's anything that really doesn't work, is when I see them the next time, because those things that we plan, we never actually do. There's a reason they exist in our minds. It's because they're the very things we're never going to do in public. So these are some of the intellectual things we can remember. But really, this is a very much a heartfelt or an emotional experience. And so tonight's meditation is going to be about developing empathy, which is the foundation for forgiveness, and then we're going to be doing some forgiveness. Now, forgiveness and empathy is very much a long practice. It doesn't happen. It's a process. It doesn't happen very quickly. And we'd love it if it was. For two reasons. It would be easy, and B, we can just, if it wasn't a process, we could say, I tried. I tried to forgive that schmuck. I thought nice thoughts. I said, he's a human being. Fuck him, but I forgive him. And I'm still angry now. What the fuck? Fuck him. You know. I tried. I really tried. It was Tuesday night at 7:30, and I thought a good thought about him, and fuck. The anger's back. There's no forgiving that schmuck. So, no, it's a process. It's not, very little is going to change when we do tonight's exercise, other than we're going to introduce you to a process that you can use and return to, and over time, I guarantee you, it does work if we open our hearts to it. I grew up in one of those drunk Russian families. And trust me, Russians actually can drink, and you might not know that. But it turns out we're capable of consuming massive amounts of alcohol. My dad was really quite good at that. When my mom was pregnant with me, he was in the hospital in a coma from a bar fight. Such was his sense of priorities. And he was a pretty violent, scary guy. We'd have the police visiting us and all kinds of stuff. And over years of practice, I forgave a lot of really, really difficult experiences, which I entertain my friends with, but would make tonight far too long. So trust me, over time, these practices do work. Now, There's something called psychodrama, which has a practice called role reversal. And in role reversal, what we do is, although I've never actually done psychodrama, but I understand this from good sources, is that people will play us and will play the other person in our conflicts or in our dramas in life. So we can try to understand things from their perspective. And the beauty of our practice is that we can also do this in our practice. We don't actually need the people to be present. We can actually, using our meditation, we can actually, and our imagination, we can skillfully reflect on the experience of somebody with whom we've had conflict, and we can open to them. We can also, as I said, connect with them just as a living, breathing entity. We can connect with them. We can begin to understand the underlying emotional experience which motivates the things they've done and said. And we might not be able to fully inhabit or fully understand, but we can open a crack, and sometimes that crack is just enough to begin to soften our hearts where there's armoring and hurt and resentment. We can begin to feel the sympathetic feelings and open to the sadness that we feel at the results of conflict, the broken relationships, the friends that we haven't spoken with, the co-workers where there's tension, and the romances that have fallen apart far too quickly. And again, a process. But every time we engage, even if we don't immediately feel a breakthrough, just the act of turning towards trying to build compassion and empathy away from the obsessive narration of blame, self-justification, or beating up on ourselves, just this practice in itself can bring a great deal of relief and a great deal of easing. So, with that, find a comfortable seated position. So the first part in any practice is always going to be developing ease. I also ask, for the sake of tonight's practice, that we don't use someone with whom we've experienced a great trauma, or someone who's absolutely central to the wounding we've experienced. Don't use, you know, mother or father. Start with someone that doesn't come with as much thinking in history. It's very worthwhile to work up, to first develop a practice, and then, as we become willing, to turn towards the most difficult experiences. So I prefer, like, we use a roommate or somebody we know that we've had difficulties with, rather than someone who's, you know, we've had a really traumatic experience with for years. So close the eyes, and let's start by just bringing all of our awareness into the present moment, and we can do that by just turning towards first the sensations of contact with the ground, contact with the clothes, contact with our hands on our legs. And if there's anything right now that you need to adjust to feel comfortable, feel free to do that. this is very much a practice that should be done in comfort. So if at any time during this meditation you feel a physical discomfort, being with physical discomfort is not tonight's practice. So very quietly, so that nobody around you will be disturbed, and very slowly, you can always slightly change your position. But again, put other people's comfort also foremost in mind, so that we don't move in a way that is disturbing. So bring the awareness into the top of the head, and we're going to scan down through the body. First, just do a pass, just scanning through, becoming aware of all the different regions. And as you do, try to distribute any energy in the body to the spine to keep you upright. If you notice that you're slouching, try to gently pull back your shoulders and push the belly a little forward to straighten the spine, and gently, without any force, tuck in the chin so that the back of the neck extends. So just scan down through the body as if you've never been in a human body before, and your awareness is just moving from the topmost sensations down to the contact sensations with the floor, and you're just going to acquaint yourself with what it feels like to be incarnated in a human form without any prejudgment or any expectation. As you've never been in a body before, you have no idea what it should feel like or what feels good or bad. You're just taking in all the sensations. And try to do this without visualizing what you look like externally. So we're just feeling the sensations in and of themselves. Now for our second pass, we're going to try to develop ease. We're not going to force anything to relax, but where there is muscle contraction, any unnecessary tightness or sense of fidgetiness, we're just going to invite each region of the body to relax. I'll name a few areas, but feel free to move at your own pace. So invite the forehead to soften and the eyes to settle if they're moving. Encourage the jaw to release if it's clenched. And if an unforced smile is available without too much effort, allow it to form. If you feel any tightness at the base of the throat, that can be easily released. Again, invite it to do so. noting the muscles in the back of the neck. If you feel any tightness there, just think thoughts of ease. Feeling the in-breath move up through these muscles and then the out-breath softening and releasing. Then, as if we're putting down two heavy bags that we've been carrying around, just feel the shoulders releasing away from the ears, sloping down. Again, not sloping forward so that we slouch, but just releasing. If the shoulders are slightly tucked back, then that opens up the chest, which makes a lot of room for the in-breath. And then moving our attention to the belly, just encourage the belly to soften. We don't push out the belly, we just release or invite any holding or contraction that's habitual to gently release as much as possible, knowing that some of the holding are just old emotions that are not going to easily release. So we don't force anything. Allowing the buttocks to release, so we sink down into the cushion, and then moving our awareness down the legs, releasing any tendency to contract those muscles. Bringing the awareness to the palms of the hands, really soften this area. And gradually scanning up the arms, releasing any holding. And this brings our awareness back to the chest. So at this point, open your, or tune your awareness to the feelings of the in-breath and the out-breath. If you feel it most in the belly or in the tip of the nose, that's fine. For the course of this practice, it's best to, if possible, encourage an awareness of the breath inside the torso. And if it helps, you can take an exaggerated deep in-breath. Then release and feel that release as if it's softening every sensation. So with each out-breath, see if you can surf down the sensations of releasing, trying to ride them as long as possible, extending each wave of exhalation as long as it can. And then the inhalation is like paddling back out into the ocean. And then there's the pause waiting for the crest of the wave and then surfing back out, trying to extend the length of each wave of exhalation as long as it can, releasing any tension, allowing the awareness, which is normally up in the eyes, to glide down in the body, following the sensations of releasing. So at this point, allow the sensations of the breath to fade a little bit from the forefront. Like they're a character on the stage that has moved into the background of the stage, you can now still see or experience the breath, but it's not at the front of your awareness. And at this point, bring to the front of your awareness the image of someone with whom you've had a recent disagreement or conflict, falling apart. And just hold that image in your awareness. Now, if you can't easily bring their image to mind, if the visual doesn't come easily, just feel their presence. But try to either hear their voice, see their clothing. And as you bring the image to mind, try to make it as detailed as you can. You want to really hold and sustain this presence. And we do so by really filling it in. See if you can remember hair texture, the lines on the face, or the characteristics of the eyes, the way the mouth is held. It's really connecting with a sense of what it was like to be around the other without any of the stories, without any of the history, just reopening to the sensation of being with that other in mind. Opening our hearts to this is a being that is like us, aging, filled with fears, filled with unmet goals, a being that has experienced rejections and abandonments and losses, just like all the other inevitable experiences in all lives. This is a being that's been overwhelmed now, again, without returning to any story or narrative of what happened during any conflict, just ask ourselves, what did this person want? What were they hoping for? What would motivate this want or this need? If it's attention, was it motivated by loneliness or fear or isolation? If it was power, were they feeling unworthy or small? What would make somebody want what they were wanting? This is another being filled with responsibilities and obligations and all the uncertainties that we face. How did they feel? Were they overwhelmed? See if we can make any felt connection, no matter how small, So now, knowing that in some way our connection with this person has been disrupted, see if you can cultivate the following thoughts, or thoughts in your own words, so just allowing the thoughts to float down from the mind into the body. For as much as I am capable of now, I forgive myself for my actions and unskillfulness. Simply knowing that I will try to do better in the future to cause less harm. Even if we can't think of any thing we've done wrong, that's all right. It's open to the possibility that there was some element of our actions we were unaware of that might have been read as harmful. For any acts I have caused, intentional or otherwise, that might have caused harm. As much as I'm capable of doing right now, I forgive myself. With when we forgive ourselves, we're much more likely to act skillfully, because blaming only makes us more defensive and frightened. And then bringing the other person back into the forefront of our awareness, if they've faded a little. As much as I am capable of right now, just as I have forgiven myself, for the sake of releasing the agitation, mental busyness that I've added and experienced, for the sake of redeveloping empathy and compassion, which are the most comfortable experiences of the mind, as best as I can do right now, I forgive you. Knowing that each of us is responsible to live in the results of our actions. So each of us have to face the repercussions of what we've done. Forgiving doesn't get anyone off the hook. We do it to release the anger stories, resentment stories. To open to the possibility of change. As much as I can do now, just as I've forgiven myself, both now and in the past, as much as I can, I forgive you. So allow the image to drift away, to fade, and bringing the awareness back to the breath and the body, and just notice if any tension has returned. Taking a deep breath and releasing any stress, contraction. Returning fully into the body. And while keeping the body in your mind when the time is right, while looking at the ground, you can open your eyes. Thank you.